Last January, Angela Hewitt slipped and fell 90 minutes before a performance. But the show must go on. That is literally how she lives her life. And she gave that concert, even though she was in a lot of pain. Recently, she revealed the backstory. What was happening that afternoon before that performance? Well, she was filming a documentary about a Lifetime Achievement Award she was going to receive on June 2nd. You'll find out more about that as we dive into her latest edition of her Beethoven cycle. It's Volume 7. I'm Julie Amacher. This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. So, Angela, tell me a little bit about the newest installment of your Beethoven Sonata cycle. I know this is Volume 7. How far along are you in the cycle so far?
Well, actually, I've already recorded Volume 8, and it's already done and edited. It will be out next year, I believe. So I just have one more CD in the cycle to do. Mind you, I've left Opus 111 and the Hammerklavier Opus 106 for the last CD, so that's a little bit of work, especially since I've never played those pieces before. But I'm thrilled that this one is finally out now, and it's wonderful to be so far advanced in the cycle. You know, when I started, I think it was something like 13 years ago, the volume on which I did the Passionata, I remember. I wasn't setting myself a time limit to do it. I really wanted to do it in my own time. And so many of the earlier albums had sonatas on that I've played a lot in my life. And then the more I got along, they were ones that I learned along the way, but of course performed a lot before recording them, which I always believe in. So on this latest disc, we have, as I've wanted to present on every disc, one well-known sonata. We have The Tempest, and we also have Opus 109, which I hadn't played until a few years ago. I had played Opus 110 and Opus 101 very early on in my university and early 20s in those years. But I left Opus 109 till now, and I'm rather happy about that. We can talk about that in a minute. And then I have the Opus 27, number 1, which is the sonata that comes right before the Moonlight, which is also entitled Quasi una Fantasia. And then the little Opus 79 in G major to complete the recital. And that's always been my aim in each Beethoven disc, is to present more of a recital than anything in chronological order.
So when you're putting together one of these recitals, what's your goal?
Well, my goal is to present a CD that really should be listened to from beginning to end without interruption. That's not always, but when I think it's great if the listener can do that at first, because I consider everything, the order of the sonatas that I present, the gaps between the movements and the gaps between the pieces, the contrast, some might be related. In fact, Opus 79 and Opus 109, which follow each other on this disc, there's some thematic unity between the last movement of Opus 79 and the first movement of Opus 109, which is rather lovely. So although I'm not against anyone dipping into one track on a sample thing, it really is designed to be listened to as a recital.
So since you brought up the thematic unity between the final movement of Opus 79 and the first movement of Opus 109, let's talk a little bit about that, because how would you explain that to somebody who's just discovering these two Beethoven sonatas?
Well, the descending motive that begins Opus 109, it's hard to illustrate that without a piano, I must say. Da-dum-be-deem, ba-dum-be-deem. That's also used as it's the same thing in the beginning of the Opus 79. Now, I don't think he really had that in mind. It just happened that way. Perhaps he did. And I didn't even notice it at first, to tell you the truth. But then I realized it was there. But it is quite a common progression. But it's an interesting gesture that he's done that.
I love that, how you admit that you didn't even notice that at first, because you're so immersed in this. So for someone who might be new to classical music, who thinks they have to know everything about it to understand it.
Yeah, no. I mean, things like that can come later. I mean, it's a little bit like Bach. You can appreciate it on so many different levels just for its beauty alone. And yet the more you know about it, the more you can appreciate in it. So the same with Beethoven, really.
Well, let's go back to the beginning of this recording and talk about The Tempest, which comes from the Shakespearean title. But it really is it associated with Shakespeare in any way?
No. Well, a friend of his said to him, Schindler, I think, the critic, said, what does this sonata mean? And perhaps Beethoven was a bit fed up with him or fed up with the question. And he just said, go and read Shakespeare's Tempest. So he said, no, nothing more than that. So I wouldn't say that there's really a program in it, no. But there's a definite mood, I find, in this piece. It's quite unique among the sonatas. First of all, it's his only sonata in D minor, a key which he used for the Ninth Symphony. You know, it is a tragic key, and this comes out right away, really, in the opening movement. It has many rhetorical passages. I think that's the most important sort of link with something that might be related to words, poetry, verse. In the first movement, it has these recitative passages that we get right really in the first bar. And then also in the development section. It's like the action stops for just a moment, and then there's this wonderful comment. The slow movement is among the most beautiful he wrote. I think it's full of tenderness and could be a demonstration of what Prospero felt for his daughter, Miranda. Last movement, which Beethoven evidently said to somebody, it was inspired by seeing a horse and a horseman galloping by his window, on a stormy night. But I don't know about that. This perpetual motion that it has does put you in a little bit of a trance, that's for sure.
Mentioned this tragic key signature in this piano sonata in D minor known as The Tempest. And this actually is one of the few times that Beethoven used this key of D minor. Why do you think it's so significant for this sonata?
Well, D minor, even in Baroque times, had a certain character. When you think of pieces by Bach also in this key, in the Preludes and Fugues, the D minor, they have a seriousness, they have a weight, they have a certain melancholy. But I'm sure Beethoven was thinking, of the characteristics of D minor when he chose it for The Tempest. And so, it's stormy, it's tragic, it can also be melancholic. But those, in Baroque times, there were charts, actually, with the characteristics of each key. So it was something that composers thought of. They didn't just choose a key randomly. It really had to mean something. And I think it's quite evident here that it sets this piece apart.
And it also was written not too long after he really came to terms with his deafness.
That's right. Yes.
Do you think that you know, his emotional state is represented in this work?
Oh, yes, most definitely. Yes, it was written around the time of his Heiligenstadt Testament, in which he really revealed for the first time the extent of his deafness and how it made him be apart from the world, and not, you know, what difficulty he had in communicating with people and how isolated he felt and what it meant for his future. This piece, probably more than any other piece right at that time, is reflective of that.
It's also a very personal work for you, right? It's one of your personal favorites. Why is that?
Well, I adore the theater. I adore The Tempest by Shakespeare. I actually performed this on Shakespeare's birthday once in Wigmore Hall, which I thought was very fitting. And I like the theatrical element in music, the drama. It's something that I love to bring out. But it's also, I mean, there are parts in the last movement, too, in the development section where it's all almost Bachian in the counterpoint. The two hands are sort of repeating the motive in imitation. So, yes, it's almost Bachian in its counterpoint at times, and that always suits me as well. But I think it is because I really love the dramatic and the theatrical and music, and I do find that in this piece I can put that to good use.
Let's talk a little bit about the piano sonata in E-flat major, opus 27, number 1. This is a twin to the more famous Moonlight Sonata. Is this a work that you've been playing for quite a while, or is it new to your repertoire?
No, it was also new in the 2 years before the recording or something. But it's one that I've always wanted to learn, just had never got around to it, because I adore that A-flat major section, which is considered the third movement. You know, it's really played all in one without stopping this piece, but it is the very brief third movement. And when I started learning it, I realized it's much more complicated to play than it looks. There are a lot of decisions to take. It's very tricky. That last movement, too, it's very difficult to play. And even just at the very beginning, because the music is so simple. And I remember when we were recording it, we tried different things, different tempi, different moods. But in the end, it just has to flow easily and be a little bit naive. And then that movement in C minor there. That's very difficult to play as well, because you can't just cloud it all in pedal. It has to be quite clear. He marks the articulation, the three notes, each three notes in a group. I mean, some people might play it with a lot of pedal, but I think it's better without. It requires a lot of work. In the middle part of that, it goes into A flat major. And then has syncopated notes in the right hand.
Which almost gives you the feel that you're riding a horse.
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely, you have to imagine yourself on a horse there. Yeah, that's what I imagine at that point. And then he goes back into the spooky C minor after that. There's a lot of so much humor in Beethoven, even in the tragic stuff. But that's one part where you have to bring out the humor, I think.
Well, the Sonata in G Major, number 25, Opus 79, has a nickname that I didn't know about: the cuckoo.
Yeah, that's right, because there's a motive, dum-bum-bum-bum, that comes in all through the first movement, with some hand crossing as well. And so I think it's the French, actually, who initiated that, called it Le Coucou. But, it's considered one of the easier pieces. It's almost a sonatina, really. But again, nothing is easy. The first movement is also a dance. It's a Tedesca, a German dance, so very sprightly. And you have to get that feeling in it somehow. You know, it has to get up off the ground. The second movement is a beautiful Venetian gondola song. Now, Beethoven never went to Venice, but he certainly must have known about it. And it's funny, not a lot of people mention that in their notes, but to me it's so clear that it is. And in fact, I played it in Venice recently in a program I did of music and poetry. And it's so clearly like a gondola, you know, Venetian gondolier song. Very simple melody, but it has that wonderful character and flow. And I think Beethoven must have had fun putting that one together, I think.
Now, the Sonata in E major, Opus 109, the final movement, is the longest movement. It's also the heart of the work, and it's a series of variations. What do you find so moving about this particular movement in this sonata?
Oh, it's immensely personal, and of course, by this time he would have lost his hearing, and it's very much like the Goldberg variations. Now, again, Beethoven must have known the Goldberg, I think. It must have been circulating in copies, at least. And because we have this beautiful, beautiful theme, which is, in fact, a saraband, so a dance also that Bach used for his theme of the Goldberg, which returns at the end. And again, we have that feeling, as we do in the Goldberg, that the theme comes back from afar when it does reappear after all that's happened in between. Of course, the Beethoven is much shorter than the Goldberg variations, but still it covers a lot of ground from this sort of the aria-like first variation, very stately. And then the pointillistic second variation. Then at the end, the final variation is almost like an earthquake, you know, this huge rumbling in the bass. And at the extremes of his keyboard, at least, as it was at the time, and you can imagine, people must have thought he was mad writing such stuff. It's a very difficult movement I found to sort out, to memorize, to find the right relationship between the variations, to build up this incredible strength at the end. With when you have nothing in the middle of the keyboard, you know, just extreme top and bottom, it's to get the strength without being harsh. I found that was very important and difficult. And then to make the join back into the theme. I think there's a lot, you know, not written in the score in this piece that you have to somehow find and interpret. And I'm not saying that this is my absolute last word on the piece. I hope to play it a lot more in my life and discover new things. But it's certainly one of the most moving pieces I think you can play.
Well, this past winter, you endured a little fall, and
yes.
Show went on.
I did.
Would you care to share that story and kind of the secret behind it?
no secret, but I was performing for the first time in 10 years, the complete book one of the Well-Tempered Clavier, in Oxford on January 24th. And we'd been filming at the rehearsal because a Canadian film crew had come over to film me in advance of my Governor General's Awards coming up in early June. And so I was already dressed in long gown and high heels at the rehearsal. And as film crews always do, they were running a bit late and I was getting a bit worried about the time and I still had to eat dinner. And anyway, the dressing room was not in the church. It was in a college attached next door and I had to walk through these endless corridors to get there. And it was freezing cold and I was carrying a lot of stuff in my arms and I opened this door and I simply didn't see that right away, without any warning, there were three steps and down I went. And I didn't know, but I had broken my foot. And I knew I couldn't put any weight on it. Anyway, the concert was like 90 minutes later, and people were beginning to arrive. And so, you know, I'm one of those pianists or musicians who thinks the show still has to go on. And so I had ice, and they brought me on in a wheelchair and carried me up to the piano since there were some steps there, and I still played. And I played it also in Wigmore Hall two nights later, and then I discovered I had a broken foot. But I can laugh about it now, but I'm still feeling it 3.5 months later. I've just given up the crutches outside, the one crutch anyway. It's a lesson in life, you know, it's a lesson in life. I can tell you wheelchairs and airports are very good things that get you to the front of the line. But I don't plan to do that again anytime soon. But I did, you know, I traveled the world with a broken foot for 3 months. I didn't stay at home either.
Let me ask you about that, your work ethic, if you will, because there are certainly plenty of artists who would have been, you know what, I need to take a break, I need to heal. What powered you through that, or what powers you through?
Well, my responsibility to my audiences, really, and my love for the music. But I hate to let people down, and people who have, you know, traveled from all over the world to come to hear me in a certain place. And I just can't. I only canceled one concert, like a few days after my diagnosis, so I couldn't get there. But then I had 2 weeks at home, so I was able to rest then. And then I just started traveling with friends going with me or helping me, you know, all over the place. And but yeah, I guess it's my response, you know, I feel this responsibility that I just can't bear canceling unless I can't get out of bed. That's always been my motto, I guess. But I hate canceling. That's why. I like it too much, I guess.
So one final question for you. What does it mean to you to win the Governor General's Performing Arts Award for Lifetime Achievement?
Well, I don't quite feel old enough for that. But it's a huge honor, of course, a huge honor and to be selected for this award. In the company of such people also as, you know, Geneviève Bujold, the actress, and so many notable Canadians have received this award. when I do think back and think of all the repertoire I have done over the years and the recordings and the concerts and everything, I haven't wasted my life, that's for sure. I haven't wasted 1 minute of my life. And so it's something to be very satisfied about, I think. And it's, as I say, it's a huge honor that they're recognizing it in this way. And it means a lot to me that my home country, Canada, doesn't forget me. You know, that's not always a foregone conclusion that you play a lot in your country. But I think I have 5 trips to Canada this year alone. And it's important to me that I go around the world sort of representing Canada and as a bit of an ambassadress for my country, I think. Although I've made London my home for 33 years now, I'm still very Canadian at heart.
That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. I'm Julie Almacher.